That'll be here on BBC Radio 3 at the slightly later time of 6:30 tomorrow evening. Composer of the Week is presented by Donald MacLeod. Well, looking ahead and after this evening's prom, our feature, The Idea of Sin, the Reverend Richard Coles explores the idea of sin by tackling temptation and the way sin has become not merely an archaic idea in many contemporary societies, but a positively attractive tool in the hands of advertising. As for the present, it's just coming up to 7 o'clock, and time now to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms. It's presented by Martin Handley.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Hello and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, where for this evening's first prom, we greet the Rotterdam Philharmonic with its music director, the inspirational Canadian conductor Yannick Nezet-Séguin. In this season, during which we're celebrating the bicentenary of Wagner's birth with performances of 7 complete Wagner operas, tonight we hear his only song cycle, the Wesendonck-Lieder, with its close connection both in art and in real life to his opera Tristan and Isolde. Charismatic Italian soprano Anna Caterina Antonacci is the soloist. Framing the Wagner are 2 Russian masterpieces, the symphony which Prokofiev regarded as the culmination of a large part of his career, the 5th, ends the concert, and to begin with Tchaikovsky's fantasy overture Romeo and Juliet. Yannick Nezet-Séguin enjoys building his programmes. I asked him what links the Tchaikovsky and the Wagner.
The connection I see in the first half is definitely only about the love relationship, you know. So Romeo and Juliet, and in the Wesendonck, it's all about the intimacy of that love. Of course, Tchaikovsky makes it explode in such a perfectly constructed way. This piece, Romeo and Juliet, we hear it a lot, yes, but I still believe that if you want to introduce anyone to classical music and symphonic music, that is one of the ideal pieces because it's perfect architecturally and its message is so clear.
Well, in the late 1860s, Tchaikovsky was much under the influence of the composer Balakirev, who suggested the subject of Romeo and Juliet to him. Tchaikovsky liked the idea, but soon had to confess he didn't know how to go about it. Well, there's no czar in it, no marches in it, only love, 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 said Balakirev, and sent Tchaikovsky a suggestion for the shape the piece might take. It was his idea to begin with a portrait of Friar Lawrence, who Tchaikovsky paints in the solemn chant-like opening. Then come the graphically drawn street brawls between the Montague and Capulet families before the incandescent music for the star-crossed lovers. The themes are worked together to encapsulate the conflict in the play with a sombre ending as Tchaikovsky portrays the love story's tragic outcome. Well, the leader of the Rotterdam Philharmonic, Marika Blankenstein, is already on the stage. She was who sorted out the tuning of the orchestra. Interestingly, the principal oboe stood to give his A's. I've never seen that before. All is now ready. Another very full Albert Hall on a warm but not too hot evening. And here comes Yannick Nezet-Séguin trying to find his way through the orchestra, making it to the front to conduct Tchaikovsky's fantasy overture, Romeo and Juliet.
Thank you. Thank you.
Nothing routine about that performance. Tchaikovsky's Fantasy Overture, Romeo and Juliet, which has opened tonight's first prom here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, performed by the Rotterdam Philharmonic, conducted by Yannick Nezet-Seguin. What ineffable beauty, what burning passions. It's one of the finest themes in all of Russian music. That's what Rimsky-Korsakov said about the love theme at the heart of Tchaikovsky's overture. Very compact, Yannick Nezet-Seguin, but he seems to extend himself over the whole orchestra once he gets going. It was all very restrained at rehearsal this afternoon. He said it would be, asked them not to play too much. But very different this evening. Back he comes. He's almost dressed down. White open neck shirt and black suit. There's the gentlemen of the orchestra in their tails and ladies in their black dresses. Broad grin. Very happy with the way that went, I think. Well, from Romeo and Juliet, we turn to Tristan and Isolde and the real-life love tangle that was at the heart of Wagner's opera and was the genesis of his song cycle, the Wesendonck-Lieder, that we hear now with Anna Katerina Antonacci, the soprano soloist. I asked Yannick Nezet-Seguin to tell me why he so admires her.
We fell in love with each other's artistic persona a few years ago. She represents what I can imagine in my mind of being a Greek tragedienne. She's carrying something connected to the history of our world. And whenever she's telling a story, it's on one hand very sincere because she's this very simple woman, but on the other hand, it's beyond what a simple human being can do. She speaks, we listen.
And we'll be doing that very shortly. When Richard und Minna Wagner fled Dresden in 1849 after his active involvement in the Republican revolutionary activity there, he arrived in Zurich on a false passport and remained for nearly a decade. The Wagners were befriended in the city by the businessman Otto Wesendonck and his wife Matilda. Later, the families lived as neighbours, a situation which led to the composer's infatuation with Matilda. He began writing the text for Tristan and Isolde as a way of expressing that love. She, meanwhile, was writing Tristan-esque poems in return, five of which she set to music as a kind of Tristan practice, demonstrating that she had well and truly become his muse. The poems reflect the dreamlike, unreal mood of Matilda and Richard's relationship and encapsulate the spirit of Tristan and Isolde. The first song, Der Engel, imagines an angel descending to relieve the soul of its suffering by transporting it to heaven. Stehe still, be still, speaks of the rushing, rumbling wheel of time, the only escape from which is oblivion. The central song, Im Treibhaus, in the hothouse, Wagner specifically calls a study for Tristan, and the music is that of the opening of the third act of his opera. Nature sorrows, for exotic trees don't belong in the hothouse, just as the poet feels she's not of this world. In Schmerzen, sorrows, the sorrows and joys of life are given the allegory of the daily setting and rising of the sun. And finally, Träume, dreams, a study for the love duet in Act Two of Tristan, celebrates the dream world the lovers inhabit. Well, the Rotterdam Phil has reduced in numbers. The heavy brass have left, the percussion's left, just one trumpet. Wind and strains. A bit of sorting out of stands and microphones. But now all is ready. And here comes Anna Katerina Antonacci, together with Yannick Nezet-Seguin, joining the Rotterdam Philharmonic. And again, a slightly circuitous route to the platform to perform Wagner's Wesendonck-Lieder.
Oh!
Dreams like the spring sun kissing the flowers from the snow, to grow, to bloom, to impart their scent as they dream, fading softly at your breast and then sinking into the grave. Music by Richard Wagner, orchestrated by Felix Mottl, words by Mathilde Wesendonck. In Träume, the dreams of both Richard and Mathilde. The last of the five Wesendonck Lieder performed here in the Royal Albert Hall by the soprano Anna Katharina Antonacci, for the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Yannick Nezet-Séguin. Wagner wrote in his diary, "I've done nothing better than those songs, and there's very little that I've written that can be placed alongside them." Yannick Nezet-Séguin was telling me he'd only recently conducted his first Wagner opera, Lohengrin, in Montreal, and he enjoys the intimacy of these songs, an intimacy which he feels is more prevalent in the operas than we often think. He likes the direct expression in those songs. Back come the two, Anna Katharina Antonacci and Yannick Nezet-Séguin, deep in conversation until they got onto the platform. She's continuing the black and white theme, black top to the breast, white skirt. There's this extraordinary voice, which is a kind of mixture of mezzo-soprano and soprano. I think it's called a falcon in Italy. You certainly going to be carrying on performing Carmen, which is one of her signature roles, Santa Fe, and here at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, Cassandra in Berlioz, the Trojans in Milan and Vienna. Well, after the interval, the Rotterdam Philharmonic and Yannick Nezet-Séguin returned to the platform here in the Albert Hall to perform Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony, which he pronounced, at least for the benefit of the Soviet authorities, to be about the grandeur of the human spirit. Meanwhile, for the next 20 minutes here on Radio 3, in tonight's Proms Plus, recorded early this evening at the Royal College of Music, we find out about the relationship of life in the Soviet Union to Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony. The presenter is James Jolly.
Welcome to this Proms Plus event, which we're going to be focusing on Serge Prokofiev and his Soviet years. Fiona McKnight is archivist of the Serge Prokofiev Archive at Goldsmiths, University of London. She studied music and education at the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama and the University of Glasgow. David Nees, no stranger to Radio 3, is the author of a number of books on composers, including the first volume in a biography of Prokofiev, From Russia to the West, 1891 to 1935. And he tells me that volume 2 is now underway. Now, Prokofiev is one of those composers who, with the wisdom of hindsight, you think, Why did he do that? How could he possibly have done that? So to sort of set up the Soviet years, I thought maybe we could sort of jog through the early part of his biography, and maybe, David, you could start us off.
Right, well, he was a true Petersburger, I suppose you could say, in training, although he was actually brought up on a country estate in the Ukraine, a pampered only child. His mother had lost two children before she had him, and he went to the great St. Petersburg Conservatoire. Most of the students in his class were at least 10 years older, including his lifelong friend, Nikolai Myaskovsky, and he was a precocious improviser. He'd written lots of little spiky piano pieces for family and friends and carried on doing that throughout the first years of his training. Curious to think of him as a pioneer, but in some ways he was. The Scythian suite, I suppose, of 1913-14, which was commissioned by Serge Diaghilev after they'd met in London, but rejected by him as being perhaps a bit too much like Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which of course was premiered in 1913, was resuscitated as an orchestral suite, which shocked the rather conservative Russian public, Petrograd public, as it was in 1916, because of course the war had broken out. As far as symphonies went, he started an early symphony in a kind of competition with his friend Myaskovsky, and wrote to him that he thought that a symphony should never be longer than about 20 or 25 minutes, because what can be worse than a boring symphony? So symphony number 5, we know, is 45 minutes long. So in the end, he towed the line and wrote big symphonies, but it certainly wasn't that way with his first offering, of course, the Classical Symphony, which was one of the last works he composed before he left Russia in a very turbulent state in the wake of the 1917 revolution to travel, to try and find his fortune, in fact, in America. A visit which he thought would only last 6 months, and of course he ended up not going back until 1927.
Do you want to take over the story from there and take us up to the sort of return to Russia?
It's Prokofiev's life is full of drama, I suppose, and that, you know, he left St. Petersburg on what turned out to be the last train to get across to the Far East, and he sailed. He was intending to go to South America, I think.
Yes.
But he missed a boat, and there wasn't another one for a month. So he had a little stay in Japan, and then ended up going to the United States instead.
Where would his sympathies have been at the time of the revolution? I mean, on which side?
As so often, he was simply interested in writing music and having it performed, and the circumstances just weren't there. The opportunities weren't there for him to do that at the time. So very in typical sort of single-minded, you know, style, he decided to go and try it elsewhere. So he got to America with, as he said, you know, a few pennies in his pocket. He had to borrow money from people on the boat, and he borrowed money again to get across America to New York, where he had Russians who had already gone. He had contacts there, and started trying to get primarily recitals. So he was in New York for a few years. That's where Love for Three Oranges was composed. But he met with mixed success. Rachmaninoff was there before him, and his style was absolutely what I think they expected, you know, another Russian coming over. So he left, and he headed to Europe, where initially he settled in Bavaria, and then went to Paris, where, of course, there was a huge Russian emigre community already. And he remained there, or based in Paris, we should say, until the end of 1935. I say based in Paris because he spent huge amounts of his time touring, but he constantly complained that he had no time to compose because he was always away giving concerts. By this point, he had married in 1924. He had two children in 24 and 28. And by the mid-20s, he was talking in his diaries about going back to Russia. He was very interested. He was receiving an odd word of a commission here and there, opportunities. He was hearing about his music being performed in Russia, which wasn't happening easily for him in Europe. He was working with Diaghilev, but he was always on the fringes, never quite the, you know, Stravinsky was there again. He was there before him. and he was first in Diaghilev's book. So when these overtures from Russia started to come, he thought seriously about it, but he was very wary, and he wanted assurances that if he did go, he would be able to leave again. By 1927, he was persuaded of this, and he did go with his wife on a tour, which was a massive success. From then on, in 1928, 29, 30, the end of the 20s, early 30s, he spent more and more time in Russia. So we talk about this move at the end of 35, 36, but really it was more of a gradual shift of his base of operations from being based in Paris and touring in Russia to being based in Russia and, he thought, still continuing to tour in the West. But it didn't turn out like that.
So David, the Soviets wanted him back. I mean, he was, you know, the biggest composer they could probably most likely get back. They clearly couldn't get Rachmaninoff back. They couldn't get Stravinsky back. They badly wanted him, didn't they?
Yes, and he badly wanted them in a sense that, I mean, he felt homesick, but he also liked the idea of writing music for a larger public. He wanted to communicate. He wanted to write music for children. He even wanted to write this fabulous cantata celebrating the 20th anniversary of the October Revolution, because he'd seen what the young Shostakovich had done in the 1920s, which was a period of incredible experimentation in the Soviet Union. I mean, not just in art with Malevich and so on, photography, but in music. I mean, works like Berg's Wozzeck were still being performed in Russia, Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier. Anything went at that point. But there was also this new strain of avant-garde art, of which Shostakovich was one of the representatives. And of course, in his second symphony, which was officially a cantata to October for the 10th anniversary of the October Revolution, he'd thrown in everything but the kitchen sink and written in a very experimental way. And Prokofiev in the mid-1930s thought he could do the same. Of course, not for the first time in his life, his timing was bad. And the work that he then wrote, this wonderfully inventive and peculiar between the lines cantata, was something that would have been acceptable in the 30s, in the 1920s, but the atmosphere had changed in the mid-1930s. One of the things that Prokofiev and many other composers, it has to be said, misunderstood was that the proletarian musicians' organizations, which had made his life absolute hell in the late 20s and early 30s, were dissolved and everything was brought under a general aegis for the Association of Soviet Musicians. And he didn't realize, who did at the time, that this was actually an attempt to bring everything under state control. And of course, state control by that stage meant Stalin. So he didn't read the signs, but who can blame him?
Now, he comes back to the Soviet Union. The promises look good. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years later, the trap closes and he's stuck there.
Yes. Yes, he was able to tour twice up until 1938. And, of course, famously on the 1938 tour, he was offered a contract by Disney and I think Paramount as well, yes, to stay there and to write for them. But his two sons had been left behind in the Soviet Union. They hadn't got permission to travel. So he had no choice but to go back. And I think he and his wife, you know, certainly realised as they went back, they were unlikely to return. And when they returned, his permit to travel externally was exchanged, and that was it. He never left the Soviet Union again. And that at that point, 1938, we can start to sort of trace the kind of his personal life falling apart a little. Problems in his marriage. His wife, of course, was not Russian. So while his position was not easy, hers was really difficult. He was a composer and he had commissions and he had work to do. She was a singer but was struggling to get any work whatsoever in a foreign country. She spoke Russian perfectly well, but she had loved the lifestyle in Paris and America. She was a European, and it did not suit her at all. So the things started to fall apart in the marriage, and he eventually left Lena in 1941, and for another woman who he spent the rest of his life with.
And Lena's life turned very
And Lena's life went very much downhill, because as soon as, you know, as the wife of Prokofiev, who was, you know, one of the principal composers of the the Soviet Union. She had a degree of protection, but during the war, Prokofiev was evacuated to the Caucasus and to Georgia and various places with Mira Mendelssohn, his new wife, although Lena would claim that they had never divorced, so she was actually his only wife. Lena was left behind in Moscow throughout the war with their two sons, and you know, suffered during it, and then eventually was arrested in 1948 and spent 8 years in a labour camp in the north, and in fact wasn't released until after Prokofiev's death. He had died in 1953 and she was released in 56.
Let's sort of move to the symphonies. As David was saying, he wrote the Classical Symphony in 1918. Then there were three symphonies sort of during the 20s, which two of them based on dramatic works, Fiery Angel and then Prodigal Son. Then there was quite a large gap until 1944, when the symphony we're going to hear was written. But in that period, late 30s, he wrote Romeo and Juliet. And it always strikes me as extraordinary that here's a work of Prokofiev that is incredibly accessible, unbelievably successful, but the birth pains were absolutely horrendous.
Yes, I mean, the composition of it was as easy as anything for him. He wrote it in a single summer at a country retreat for the Bolshoi artists in 1935, and it was done with incredible rapidity. And then the problems kicked in about the choice of the ending, which, believe it or not, was actually Prokofiev's and his librettist Sergei Radlov's choice, to have a happy ending in which the lovers did not die but were reunited in the nick of time. And we've actually seen this reconstruction with a rather, in my mind, slightly unsatisfactory choreography by Mark Morris, which didn't do it a great deal of favours, but it was interesting to see this fantasy ending with the music that you never hear in Prokofiev's ballet when you see the Kenneth Macmillan choreography, which of course remains incomparably the greatest, hasn't really been challenged. Maybe John Cranko has challenged it, but that's the one that remains. And we see it as one of perhaps the four great Russian ballet scores after Swan Lake, The Sleeping Beauty and The Nutcracker. Romeo and Juliet unquestionably is on that level, but it took a long time to be accepted because the authority of all people weren't happy with the changing of the Shakespearean ending. And so things also soured in 36, which of course was the very month, January, February, the very time that Prokofiev finally settled the family in Moscow, but still had this sort of 6 months away, 6 months at home arrangement. At that very point, Shostakovich's Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk came under attack in Pravda after two successful years. And then, of course, Soviet composers were very much under restraint. Prokofiev was on tour at the time it happened, so he hardly noticed it. But, of course, by the time he got back, he must have realised that things had turned out not at all as he had expected. And then, of course, there was a long interregnum, and Romeo and Juliet only finally reached the stage after many alterations, new numbers added to the score, and, of course, this completely different ending, with Galina Ulanova as Juliet, who was among the dancers, it has to be said, who complained about the score, because when they learnt it in rehearsals with a repetiteur, a pianist, they could hear everything. And, of course, a lot of the score is very chamber musical. When it came to an orchestra, they thought this is difficult to dance to, and she didn't like it. She changed her tune eventually.
And the Fifth Symphony very much draws on the same languages as Romeo and Juliet. And it's one of his very, very few works that seem to emerge almost effortlessly. There was no problem with the authorities. There was very little musical problem.
Absolutely. It's sort of refreshing to talk about a work of Prokofiev's that didn't have, because Romeo and Juliet was the first of several that, you know, that this happened with. You know, by the time he wrote the Fifth Symphony, he was already working on War and Peace, which he spent the rest of his life revising, and never saw it performed. Semyon Kotko huge problems, all sorts of problems, not just that the music wasn't satisfactory, but the people that he was working with came under unfavourable attention and were arrested. So the Fifth Symphony, very unusually...
And he wrote it at a large part of it at Ivanovo, which was this sort of Soviet holiday home, I suppose, for composers, with some very illustrious companions.
Yes, Shostakovich was there. Prokofiev referred to it in letters as the state chicken farm, and he worked, you know, he was a terribly disciplined and efficient composer, and he got up early in the morning and he sat at his desk until 6 o'clock, and then while others like Shostakovich were playing tennis or football, he would play bridge or chess, and that was his relaxation, and it suited him terribly well, because he'd spent all these years, you know, trying to compose on trains, you know, between touring from one concert to another, and this is what he had been seeking in a way, the space and the time to compose. And despite the fact that this was during the war, Prokofiev's war years were terribly productive. He composed a huge amount of music. He was evacuated along with all the major composers to the Caucasus and so on, and he just produced music. And the Fifth Symphony, as you say, shares material with the happy ending of Romeo and Juliet. Some of that music which wasn't used, in typical Prokofiev style, he recycled it. He considered it good material. He didn't want to waste it, and he used it in the second movement of the Fifth Symphony. And he does this a lot. And actually, some of the other material, he used his favoured method of composition, which was he had sketchbooks, notebooks, really, in which he wrote down themes, just melodies, a few bars, and he did this throughout his life. And when he came to put a work together, it was often a case of putting it together from thematic material that he had written, often many years before. Some of the material in the Fifth Symphony can be dated to the early 30s.
And he conducted the premiere himself, and it was a great success. But the circumstances of the premiere were somewhat unusual, or the timing, perhaps.
Yes, I mean, Sviatoslav Richter writes about this beautifully in his memoirs, about the fact that just before the start, when Prokofiev, as he described it, stood like a noble statue on the podium, the guns were heard saluting the Red Army's crossing of the Vistula, so it was a real turning point in the war. And I suppose that, and Prokofiev's official, and I feel always wrongly taken statement, it's Soviet speak, pure and simple, that this is a symphony of the triumph of the human spirit, have led it to be hailed as a great war symphony. And what fascinates me is that it is certainly taking its cue from another symphony, which was a corrective to something chaotic and anarchic. That's to say, Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, after the incredible experimentalism of his Fourth, which had reached final rehearsals in 36 and then was withdrawn, that was the kind of cue for the sort of symphony you should write. And yet what fascinates me is not the correspondences with Shostakovich's Fifth. And of course, remember, fifths are very important. Beethoven is the model. It's a progress from darkness to light, therefore. If you look at Prokofiev's Fifth, it's not a progress from darkness to light at all. It's something very different. He'd actually done that in an interim work, which we could say is the missing link symphonically. Symphonic song, short piece, which really does start with darkness, then struggle, then achievement, a big, beautiful melody. The sort of melodies that Prokofiev newly manufactured as he was moving back to Russia. This was a new phase in his development.
What would the ideal socialist, realist symphony have been? I mean, what would the Soviets have expected? What do they want from a symphony?
Well, there hadn't really been guidelines, had there, up to that point. And you did what you wanted. And Shostakovich found out that he couldn't do what he wanted, which was the Fourth Symphony, which ends very bleakly, pianissimo C minor. He makes a comment, what if I had to end with the Fifth, optimistically fortissimo in B-flat major, and that kind of seemed one way of doing it. Prokofiev, it seems to me, found this solution of taking gallops, jolly Soviet gallops, with a nice little blithe, rustic, socialist, realist, happy peasant themes, and subverting them. I mean, I don't know how you feel about the end of the finale, but it seems to me that what begins very blithely actually can have the potential to turn extremely nasty. The mechanism almost
insistent.
Gets out of control and gets very dissonant.
How do you see the end? I mean,
yeah, I think you're right, and not just the end, but throughout this, you know, what, as you say, on the surface is a quite a pretty and, you know, socialist realist approved thing. It has this slightly, what can begin as just an insistence, but can, you know, come through as something a bit more threatening.
Yes.
And on that, we've run out of time. So Fiona McKnight, David East, thank you very much, and thank you.
In that edition of Proms Plus, recorded earlier this evening down at the Royal College of Music, it was presented by James Jolly. The producer was Janet Tuppen. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Hanley. The second part of this prom, live here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, being given by the Rotterdam Philharmonic, conducted by its music director, Yannick Nezet-Segar. He told me he believes his orchestra is a real reflection of its city, a city badly damaged in the Second World War, and which has since kept a sense of rebuilding in its inhabitants, its architecture, and its orchestra.
This orchestra knows and stands by its own personality, which is very forward, not afraid to show some muscle, you know, but it still is also an orchestra which has immense emotional power.
It sounds like an ideal orchestra to play Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony, I would say. Now, he made this famous remark that it was about the grandeur of the human spirit for official Soviet consumption. What is the symphony about? What do you feel?
I actually said to the musicians a few days ago, let's not try to add layers to it and remember to go beyond what's written. I think in the case of this symphony, it works best if we simply play what's on the page and play that joy, which in the end becomes something extremely twisted and manic and obsessive, definitely in the last movement, the second movement as well. And I think if you just play it very naturally, it comes out as this most touching, a message that's much beyond what he wrote about it.
And you heard the promenaders telling us that they've raised £53,000 for musical charities, the Rotterdam Philharmonic. Very impressed by that, I think. Prokofiev wrote the Fifth in 1944, his first symphony for 15 years, his first since he'd returned to the Soviet Union from his self-imposed exile. Naturally, he knew all about the troubles Shostakovich had gone through, charged with flagrant modernism in his music by the regime, and how he'd fought back with his Fifth Symphony. Prokofiev worked at high speed on the symphony during the summer while staying at the composer's rest home in a converted state farm many miles from Moscow. Most of Russia's foremost composers were working there, as attested to by Prokofiev playing through the finished symphony on the piano in his cottage to Kabalevsky and Shostakovich, among others. Prokofiev was nervous, his little audience reported, perhaps because the Fifth Symphony was particularly important to him. He said he regarded it as the culmination of a long period of his creative life. He conducted its hugely successful premiere, as we've heard, in the interval early in 1945, when the fortunes of war were bringing new hope to the Soviet people. Only a few days later, the 54-year-old composer suffered concussion from a bad fall down a flight of stairs, and the effect stayed with him for the rest of his life, limiting the amount of work he could do. And here once again comes Yannick Nezet-Segar, sashaying past the double basses and the cellos, and arriving at the rostrum to bring the Rotterdam Philharmonic to its collective feet before performing Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony.
Thank you.
Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony ending enigmatically, twistedly, tonight's conductor said, and seeming far from being concerned with the grandeur of the human spirit, as the composer claimed to the Soviet authorities. It's being performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to end tonight's first prom, live on Radio 3, by the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra, led by Marika Blankenstein and conducted by its music director, Yannick Nezev-Tegan. They began their season with this a couple of days ago at the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, and they're off tomorrow to Bremen to do it again in a couple of days' time, and then on tour in Italy. Yannick Nezev-Tegan has quite a portfolio, really. He's still artistic director of the Montreal Metropolitan Orchestra, where he's been for well over a dozen years. He's recently music director of the Philadelphia, just about to start his second season. Principal guest conductor of the London Philharmonic, of course. Back he comes, broad beam on his face now, wandering through the orchestra to bring up the wind section. And the horns. Piano and harp. Always such a fierce piano part in Prokofiev. And the trumpets. Brazen sound tops the whole thing off, and the heavy brass. This orchestra got a new principal guest conductor. That's the percussion. New principal guest conductor, someone we know very well in this hall, Jiří Bělohlávek. And Yannick Nezev-Tegan on the rostrum, bringing the entire Rotterdam Philharmonic to its feet. As he said when he was talking to me earlier, you just play the notes and it conveys much more than it says theoretically. Those twisted Soviet marches, gallops, thunder from the promenaders. A certain amount of shifting around of music going on the stage amongst the percussion, so I suspect we might have a little more. Back onto the rostrum goes Yannick. Brings the orchestra to its feet. And I suspect the word has gone round that we're going to get a little more. Indeed we are.
Thank you.
Folk Festival from Shostakovich's music for the 1955 Soviet film The Gadfly. Wonderful encore to send us off into the evening with. Next thing Yannick Nezet-Seguin and the orchestra do together is The Flying Dutchman, something very different to concert performances of the opera in Dortmund and in Paris, as well as at home in Rotterdam. Well, in under an hour's time, we'll be back here at the Albert Hall for music from around the world, not least the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan, homeland of an 18-year-old member of the World Roots Academy, playing alongside her mentor. Add to that, musicians from Mali should make for some colourful late-night listening. Tomorrow evening at 7.30, more Shostakovich here, the Warsaw Philharmonic and Anthony Witt ride into town, the Sixth Symphony and Second Piano Concerto with Alexander Melnikov. Add to that, Lutoslavsky's magnificent concerto for orchestra should be another evening's unmissable music-making. But for now, as Yannick Nezet-Seguin brings the individual string sections to their feet, time to get back to Broadcasting House for a brief respite before the next starburst of live music-making. So time to deliver you into the safe hands of Jonathan Swain. Jonathan.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's first prom here on BBC Radio 3 next Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Also, of course, if you want to listen to it when you want to listen to it, every prom's available to listen to online via the Radio 3 website anytime you like for 7 days from the broadcast.
On BBC Radio 4...
I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Martin Luther King delivered his famous speech at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial. 50 years on, we bring together the words of Dr. King with the voices of global figures who have devoted their lives to the cause of justice and freedom.
I have a dream today.
I have a dream on BBC Radio 4 next Wednesday morning at 9.
Well, back here on Radio 3 in just over 5 minutes tonight, our feature, the Reverend Richard Coles, continuing his series exploring the idea of sin. For the moment, well, I wonder if you heard the American composer-pianist Frederick Gzewski at Monday's late-night prom playing his own piano concerto. This is one of his North American ballads written in 1979 and giving political songs the Bach chorale treatment. This first of the ballads is based on a spiritual called Down by the Riverside, frequently sung in the heyday of the peace movement at the height of the Vietnam War. The theme, Gzewski says, is treated in a disarming manner, all puns intended, before reappearing in more elaborate guises. The pianist is the Canadian Milton Schlosser.
Thank you.
the first of the four North American ballads by the American Frederick Jevski. Dreadful Memories, it's called. The ballads themselves from the late 1970s, and the pianist was Milton Schlosser. And you can catch up with Jevski playing his own newly written piano concerto at Monday's Late Night Prom via the Radio 3 website. Other music in the prom included Morton Feldman's Coptic Light. It was a truly offbeat late night prom and well worth hearing if you missed it on Monday night. Well, the proms aren't the only summer music festival we're covering at the moment. Weekday mornings, we're live at the Edinburgh Festival. Tomorrow, pianist Pierre-Laurent Aymard contrasts a selection of Debussy preludes with the fireworks of Ligeti's Etudes. That's our live concert from Queen's Hall in Edinburgh as part of Radio 3's coverage of the Edinburgh Festival, and it starts at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. BBC Radio 3 is 9:15. Well, now our feature, the second of a three-part series examining the idea of sin. In today's programme, the Reverend Richard Coles tackles the lure, promise and menace of temptation.
Well, you join us at the beating heart of Mammon. I'm standing just by Oxford Circus in London, with Oxford Street extending on both sides, and along its length, the enchantments of retail. Shops, brands, all familiar, lining the route. And of course, the messages that adorn them tended to draw us in. Voluptuaries of one kind or another, temptations of one kind or another, the sort of vocabulary and the imagery and the symbolism of sin.
Muraqaba is monitor yourself, watch yourself. You know what you are doing. You don't need a scholar. You don't need a priest. You don't need someone who is telling you this is wrong. You know it. So face it.
Both in Hinduism and in Buddhism, an over-reliance on yourself, a fixation on your own desires, is going to lead you in the wrong direction. That it's giving into trishna, which in Sanskrit is thirst, desire.
Dr. Jessica Fraser of the University of Kent and Professor Tariq Ramadan of St. Anthony's College, Oxford, reminding us that Christianity has no monopoly on the idea of sin. In last week's programme, we noted that wrongdoing was being done long before the great monotheistic religions got systematic about it. Why? Because it's fundamental to human identity and culture, displayed in the great medieval dooms we looked at last week, and it said no less evident in our post-Enlightenment world. In this programme, then, we look at what drives us to do those things which we ought not to have done. Temptation.
I want a little sugar in my bowl.
Temptation, in my view, is when we seek to satisfy some kind of wish, desire, need or want.
Paul Gilbert is Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Derby. He's interested in how the idea of sin, shaped by religious tradition and thinking, might extend beyond them.
So funny, I feel so sad.
I'm tempted to take the drugs or have another drink or eat too much. And then there are temptations which are harmful to you and others, and then that takes you into guilt. Or there are temptations that are not so harmful. But I think mostly, I might be wrong about this, but I think mostly temptations are associated with the possibility of harm. Yeah, because I often get tempted to go back to smoking. I used to be a smoker. But the point is that I know I'm taking a risk if I do that, so I don't particularly want to be tempted. But I used to enjoy smoking, so that's the temptation, the desire to do something I would enjoy or want or need or whatever, but there's a risk to it. Whereas if there's no risk to it, then presumably there's no harm in it. If there's no harm in it, why would it be a temptation? I mean, why would we use the concept of temptation?
Popular culture is a rich source of reflection on sin and temptation, but it's hardly as exhaustive as Thomas Aquinas, nor as urgent as hellfire preachers would have it. It's lightened, Disneyfied, I suppose, even in the wilds of the jungle.
Trust in me, just in me.
Kaa from Jungle Book looking for his lunch, but his lunch Mowgli always escapes. Preachers have been less willing to let us off so lightly.
Hold still, please.
The arbiter of truth is not popular culture, and it's also not popularity. The arbiter of truth for me is Holy Scripture, And for me, Holy Scripture is the Old Testament and the New Testament as an Orthodox with a small O, evangelical Christian.
Dr. Richard Land, president of the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission in the United States. Many, like him, have argued that sin and temptation have lost their savour in an era when our understanding of what is good and what is bad lacks clarity.
Sin is defined in Scripture quite clearly as missing the mark, going over the boundary. In the New Testament, there are at least seven words that are used to describe sin. The most common one being hamartia, which means to be off the standard or to miss the mark, to fall short of God's standards. It's a lack of conformity to the will and the glory of God. We don't want to call anything a sin anymore. We want to call it a mistake. We want to call it a regret.
We sometimes are very hard on ourselves and look back and think, oh, in the 1920s and everyone shone their shoes and men wore hats when they went out and wasn't that great.
Janet Soskis, Professor of Philosophical Theology at Cambridge University, is sceptical that in the past the sum of human virtue was any greater than it is today.
There was lots going on that wasn't so good then. In some ways we are. I think, speaking as a woman, I'm very glad I live now. I think I'm much better treated as a woman. I think we're much kinder to children. I think we're kind to animals in this country anyway. I think that we're trying to be concerned about the environment. So I don't know if we're so much worse. I do think that a lot of young people feel that they haven't had much direction and wish they had had a little bit more. It's almost as though we've said, well, let's free ourselves from all the shackles of these old religions and ideologies. Good. But creeping into that void has been the mega ideology of advertising and the consuming life, the commodification of everything, which doesn't appear like a religion or a god. But that becomes very near like an idol to many of us, including, of course, many religious people in our society, holding up a whole different set of desires and things we should aspire to.
The lure of advertising with which this programme began was all around us as I walked along Oxford Street in London with one of the most senior ad men in town, David Bernstein. There's nothing new, he thinks, about the temptations that drive the consumer economy.
I actually wrote about this almost 40 years ago. I took the seven deadly sins and I looked at then-current advertising, and it was no effort to go through a page, believe it or not, of The Guardian and pick out an ad for each of the seven deadly sins.
The Guardian is for sinless people, surely.
Not quite, because I read it. And you can do it today. There was an ad for Virgin Holidays featuring a fan dancer, and the line was, see what else we're taking off. Because they were cutting the price, etc., etc.
Does that tell you something about the very basic drives of human beings everywhere?
Yeah, the basic drives of human beings everywhere, and you don't have to go far from your job to find that the seven deadly sins are totally applicable. My favourite guru in advertising, believe it or not, is Dr. Johnson. He said almost 300 years ago, the soul of an advertisement is promise, large promise. And what is a promise? It's the satisfaction of a want or a need or a desire. And so summing that up in one word, drives.
I happen to be someone who's very interested in brain science, so I'm interested in what drives people. And I've made quite a lot of studies, well, I've read studies to be truthful, about the system that runs our decision making.
Robin White, president of the creative communications company Engine, is also familiar with the drives and impulses that make us buy stuff.
Many of the decisions we make are driven off our need to pass on our genes. And that's a brain, a mind system more precisely, that is said to lodge between our ears. It's our ancient genetic mind. And that is the seat, if you like, of all the seven deadly sins. So that's your sin centre. And advertising taps into that, as indeed does religion. You know, this is what we're all looking at for different purposes.
And that our choices are made by a system which is designed to make real the best possible circumstances for us to pass on our genes.
A lot of it is that, yes.
Yeah.
And so many things derive from it. So, for example, one of the big deadly sins, lust, self-evidently, is there for that purpose, so that we can pass on our genes. And that concept of sin could be regarded as a management system coming from our neocortex that has invented a management system to control these biological urges.
So sin is a sort of way whereby our kind of higher to use a loaded word, thinking self, which is concerned with how we might relate with other human beings around us for the good of all, how that interacts with our atavistic desires for more stuff and more of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say that sin has been evolved to do that.
Lots changed in 80 years or so. And yeah. I wonder, do you think that with the way public morality, individual morality has changed, that the sort of taboos that were very powerful for the generations, the pre-war generation, I suppose, with that having broken down in the 60s and the 70s and on to now, does that make it harder for advertisers to find the sort of drives that will make people connect to a product?
I believe there are lots of changes and digital, all lots of technologies have changed, but I believe the fundamentals are virtually identical.
And sin will continue
and
to
sin,
sell.
Sin will be there. I mean, if you take the word advertising, it's 11 letters, and letters 8, 9 and 10 spell sin.
The advertising industry seems to have discovered what Dante and the painters of medieval Italy discovered before them. Sin is sexy. Sin sells. Vice is much easier to set before us than virtue. A truth acknowledged in turn by Dante, Bosch and Kenny Ball and his Jasmine, here playing the Temptation Rag.
Superbia, avarizia, luxuria, invidia, gula, ira, acedia.
The seven deadly sins come out of the Christian tradition of practice and reflection that was born in the monastic communities of the early Middle Ages. And they were set up originally as guidelines for how to commune with God. So the list that we have now, that we've inherited from then, is lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, anger, envy, and pride. And the traditional religious view of these things is that these are source sins from which all other bad stuff flows. That's why they are deadly. That's why they call the capital vices.
Dr. Simon Layam is a lecturer in psychological sciences at the University of Melbourne in Australia and the author of The Joy of Sin. He takes a rather different view of those deadly drives so perilous to preachers.
Lust is an interesting one, I think, because there's some quite counterintuitive positives to lust. One thing that lust does is it can make you smarter in a particular kind of way. So lust or sexual arousal is basically designed by evolution to allow us to get people into bed. And what it does, it comes with this mental shift that focuses our attention on the here and now and on details. And what some psychologists have found is that this attentional zoom effect that lust has can actually make us better at analytical reasoning. Analytical reasoning involves breaking a problem down into its details and working through those details. And because lust comes with this detail-focused processing shift, it can actually make us better at analytic reasoning.
Anger can be righteous. Envy can get you out of bed in the morning. Even sloth has its uses.
One of the interesting things about sloth, I think, is summed up by a quote from Robert Louis Stevenson that says, "Idleness does not consist in doing nothing, but in doing a great deal not recognised." But I think my favourite example of sloth being beneficial is that people in slower cities tend to be more helpful than people in faster cities. And there's an interesting experiment that shows that if you get people to slow down, they're much more likely to help than if they're in a hurry.
The devil, or in this case, Big Walter Horton, plays the Temptation Blues. But even these are a little enervated, surely, if temptations that once imperiled the soul are now seen as counterintuitive virtues. Perhaps that's what happens in times of growth and progress and affluence. Some preachers and theologians thought so. Historian Deborah Cohen has written about shifts in shame and guilt in 18th and 19th century Britain.
The first mass market decoration manual is written by a man, the Reverend Lofty, who plots out a scheme for a sitting room that has a quote from the Book of Job stenciled up from the fireplace. And this really massive effort to reconcile what has been thought sinful, right, which is consumerism, with godliness. You have a people who are richer than ever before and they don't want to burn in hell. Talking about people who were raised with a constant sense of scrutiny, both about the omnipresence of sin, about their own original sin, and about the need to be constantly vigilant. So this is the evangelical practice of keeping diaries, for instance, is to scrutinize every day your own motivations and your own actions. Everything, literally everything, is permeated then by a sense of sin in evangelical households. One of the oddest manifestations of that is the attempt to come to terms with material goods. So, for instance, in evangelical households, you have plates that enjoin the person who's going to eat off of them to prepare to meet thy maker, right? That's exactly what you want to have when you sit down to dinner. Or a constant reminding, especially of children, about the dangers that worldly life presents. One really good example of that is a moral tale produced for children called The Last Shop, which comes to us actually in the autobiography of a woman who tells it like this. The Last Shop. Rosie, the little girl, is told by her mother that they're going to have a lovely day of shopping and that she can buy something from every shop that she goes into, but she has to buy something from every shop. So no shop must